Please note, this podcast does not provide medical advice. The information, images, and other materials contained are for informational purposes only. No information discussed is a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please seek help from your physician for medical questions or advice. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Brain Coach Podcast. I'm your host, Mary Turos. I'm your brain coach. And my goal is to create a community of educators, therapists, clinicians, family members, researchers, and any other person who supports a healthy brain. Thanks for joining us today, and let's get started. Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Brain Coach. I am your brain coach, Mary Turos, and I just want to remind you that the whole goal of these podcasts is to create a community where we can all bring our different levels of expertise together and really normalize some of the conditions that people out there are facing. And today is a very extraordinary episode in my mind, because we're going to be talking about a condition that's very rare yet becoming very common. And so I'd like to introduce you and welcome Jory Item. She's an amazing mom out in Minnesota and most recently a surgical physician's assistant at Mayo Clinic. So thank you for being here, Jory, and welcome, welcome, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Mary.
So I just want to dive right in. And you and I have talked about this privately, but you brought to my attention a pretty serious condition known as MLD. For people like me who don't really know a whole lot about it, what is MLD? What is the acronym? What does it stand for? And what is it all about?
Sure. And it wasn't anything I knew a whole lot about in the beginning either. It's metachromatic leukodystrophy is what MLD stands for. And you're right, it's a rare hereditary disease. And it's a defect in the ARSA gene, A-R-S-A. So that gene is what causes this condition. But it's also autosomal recessive. So both copies of the gene need to be affected to have like the disease process. So when a child has it, both parents need to be carriers, and then the parents need to pass on the defective gene. So it doesn't happen all that often. And one of the things about it though, is they don't really know like exactly the statistics behind it. So it ranges between 1 in 40,000 births and 1 in 160,000 births.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, that's a huge range. And you know, so healthy people don't know they have it. And so kind of what happened in our case, so my niece has presented with this, is that, you know, she has two healthy parents, but they each were carriers of this gene and happened to pass it. And that's, you know, where the recessive part comes in, you know, that how unusual to both of them pass on this recessive gene. And then she's the one that has the disease, gets the disease process.
Right. So when did this disease first become noticeable in the medical community? Because honestly, I've never heard of it.
It's part of the dystrophies. So there's other ones that people have heard of, like, you know, like MS is sort of kind of in that it's a demyelinating disease.
Right.
So it, the defect makes it so the patient can't produce, it does, you know, that gene is supposed to tell you to produce this enzyme. And so the people that have it don't produce the enzyme, and the enzyme breaks down the myelin sheath around the neurons that help everything travel quickly and efficiently. So, there's a lot of offshoots or cousins of it that people are more aware of. But this one, I've been a PA for over 20 years and I've never come across anyone with this. It's my field surgery, but still you think you'd hear about it.
Right. And
now, though we're getting into where people are getting gene tested and they're doing it, you know, at birth or, you know, and being able to identify these very specific defects that cause the conditions. So it's hard to say what, you know, in other countries where they're not able to, you know, go get a gene test done or your genetics, what they're labeling this as. And so I think that's one of our hopes though, is that we can just kind of get a community behind it or an awareness, one of the things that it presents as, and then you could get tested for this at birth. You know, it could be part of the newborn screening.
That would be amazing.
Which would be amazing, absolutely. And I understand that. I think Pennsylvania has some new regulations now where parents can get this sort of testing of their newborns, but otherwise there's nowhere else that's doing it.
Wow.
Unless you'd have to specifically ask for it.
So what does it do to the person who has the disease?
So there's three different types of MLD. So there's a late infantile type, and that's the most severe one. And so that's real small kids, 6 to 24 months. And it's also a more noticeable one because it affects their movement. They don't learn to walk, muscle cramps. They don't learn to talk. And so that's pretty noticeable. And then there's another one, juvenile MLD, and that's the 4 to 12-year-old range. And that presentation can vary. It can start with cognitive dysfunction or it can start with motor dysfunction. It doesn't usually start with both at the same time. It's usually one or the other, and then it progresses to include both. And then, you know, these all kind of break down into more age specific. And then the adult, I don't know a whole lot about the adult type, but this presents as personality changes, difficulties at work, psychotic behavior. You can imagine that these are so often misdiagnosed.
Right.
Or just generally missed. And that's something we really hope will change.
Right. Wow. That's a lot of information. So
it's shocking, really.
Yeah. I mean, it really is. And yeah. So are there any therapies out there right now for this?
So in the US, the only thing you can have is the bone marrow transplant. Okay. And so that's, you know, you go through chemotherapy, destroy the patient's bone marrow, and then use the healthy, and it's really a stem cell transplant, because then you're giving them these stem cells that are going to tell the body what they're supposed to do.
Right.
And Italy is at the forefront of this. So Italy, they already have like gene therapy approved. And this is just absolutely fascinating. What they're doing is they are taking the patient's own bone marrow or stem cells, and then they're repairing that ARSA gene, and then they give it back to the patient. So they don't have to worry about like graft versus host disease. You still have to have some chemo because you still have to, you know, destroy and make room for the new cells, but it's the reaction and the severity of chemo and of the transplant is much less. And then, you know, if the graft takes, then that person's body is now producing the enzyme that they needed. Now their genes are, you know, that ARSA gene's working properly. It's telling the body to make this enzyme, and then it stops the demyelination.
Wow.
So that's what Italy's doing. You can get that in the US under a compassionate use. You have to petition the FDA. But the tricky thing is that you can't be symptomatic. So that gets really challenging. I mean, wouldn't we all love to be treated before we had symptoms for anything? So that's really tricky. And what the patients that fall into that, it's related to siblings. So a sibling will present with the disease. The other, usually younger siblings, will show no signs of disease, but when they do the genetic testing, they'll have it. They'll have the recessive. And so then they know this is the what you're looking at. We can fix this before it really starts. And so that, you know, and that's what I think Italy's got that one. They've got some other, so it's, you know, it starts with that and then it progresses. So now Italy will say, like, if you, you go through the testing, and your IQ is about an 85, if you meet all these parameters, we'll put you in our new study. So whatever we're doing, they're kind of two steps ahead of us.
Gotcha.
So right now we just in the US have the compassionate use.
Okay. Well, obviously your medical background helped impact the journey you're on, right?
It does.
Yeah. So how did your family figure this out? How did you arrive at the diagnosis? Was it something you were seeing? Was it something that they were, you know, your family was seeing? What were the signs?
Yeah, our path on this was just, it's unfortunate how this happened. So it was my niece, and it started, you know, probably 2 or 3 years ago as a learning disability. And she was left-handed. So within the school system, they kind of contributed her inability to write very well to, you know, left-handedness. And then COVID hit. And that it just was just poor timing to have her not an in-person school. So she was really challenged with online learning for the year. And when she went back, you know, all the kids had kind of regressed. And so it wasn't picked up in the severity if I think it was, she was seen every day in a classroom.
Right.
Where they would know she's not writing. She's not really catching the stories. She can't really repeat the stories. And so I think the trajectory from that point just kind of went in a wrong direction. And, you know, it's nobody's fault. We're not blaming anybody. It just was really unfortunate that she was out of school for that time period, because I think it probably would have been picked up on, you know. So, you know, the parents did what parents do. You know, the school says maybe she's dyslexic. They had her tested for that. She wasn't dyslexic. How about ADHD? Try some Ritalin. They took her to a neurologist, actually. And the neurologist thought, you know, maybe it's autism, maybe it's ADHD. You want to try Ritalin. She just started to get further and further behind, and her cognitive skills really regressed. And then I think the next thing that happened is she started to have falls. And then that didn't send out too many alerts within the school system, but certainly with the parents, and then with like the family saying, well, you know, and we still haven't all seen each other, because of course, like, we're, my husband and I were in the medical field. So we pretty much were locked down here in Rochester for over a year. And so we hadn't seen her, but we had started asking, you know, or talking to them about what was going on. You know, they took her to an ENT and nope, she's got to see a neurologist. And I was on a vacation and my sister-in-law called and said, you know, she is not walking properly. Should I go to the ER? And we were like, absolutely, but go to a big university ER, you know, go somewhere that's academic. And so they did, and they did one quick MRI and found that she had just tons of white matter. There's a certain, a tigroid. So it looks like tiger stripes in your brain. And that's just pathognomonic for MLD.
Oh.
So she had a really rough week that week. And what pushed her symptoms into the severity group, she also had like a UTI. So, you know, she was sick and that kind of worsened her symptoms. And so once that cleared up, her symptoms actually got better. And so her baseline is, you know, she has cognitive difficulties. She kind of walks a little wonky, but it's not as severe as when she was hospitalized. But if she were to get sick again, the same thing would happen. You just, you know, right. Like anybody, you just not right. At your body when you're sick.
Sure.
And so one of the things that really was kind of shocking to me just was the lack of continuity with other medical sites and nobody talking to each other. And that's something we do commonly here. And that's one of the reasons I'm not trying to dismiss, there's plenty of really good community hospitals and physicians and nurse practitioners and, you know, but when they're so fragmented, you almost wish, well, the ENT would have talked to the neurologist and right. said, well, this is what I found. I really think this is a neuro issue. And the neurologist would have, you know, or the school or, you know, that these people would have somehow been connected that, you know, this isn't right. my field. Do you think it could be your field? Because this is what I found, you know, so that there's just sort of a group putting their heads together right. instead of just, you know, I'm examining you. Nope, it's not me. Move on.
Right.
And that's something we're hoping to change, I guess, or to bring light to these sort of things.
And that's a big, part of why I like doing these podcasts and going out and talking with doctors and researchers, because you have to kind of thread the needle, right? If everybody's operating in isolation, then you miss little pieces. You know, something as simple as a chronic cough might exactly. be, right? So I think, and it's easy to get kind of lost in your own space. So I think the more that we can collaborate and just, even if we just riff on stuff and talk it through, I think we can provide value to somebody out there. That's my hope anyway.
Right. Right.
So, yeah. So again, I'm incredibly grateful for you sharing this information, because I know there are lots of people out there wondering about their own family. Right. So,
right.
So, but you know, in all seriousness, this sounds really like a devastating kind of diagnosis. So how's your family facing this diagnosis? Like, what are you guys doing to cope? Because it's gotta feel like the rug's been pulled out from under you.
You know, that's exactly what it feels like. It's, you know, when you have something happens so seemingly quickly, and you can look back and be like, oh, here's a little sign back then. But for the most part, you know, I think one of the things that I think put the parents at ease was, you know, they actually sold their house and moved to a single level living. Like, they're setting up everything to be the best that they can do for their right. child. And it helps you if you feel active, if you feel like you're actively participating in right. how we're going to care for her. And I think different family members process in different ways. One of the things that I've learned about myself with this experience is I do really well in a hospital, and probably because I worked in one in really intense situations for 20 plus years. And so, I really wish people who get devastating diagnoses had some kind of advocate who, you know, took the notes and asked questions, because as a parent, it's really hard to say, this is a diagnosis. We don't know if we can save your child. She's going to lose. And if you look at the trajectory of this disease, it is devastating. It's heartbreaking. And so you're a parent and you have your mind on this and your child. And then everything that's said after that first three or four, you know, words or sentences is, you're not going to pick up on it.
Right. Right.
And so I'm not intimidated in a hospital. I feel very, very comfortable being there. And so I think one of the ways we cope with it is I take a lot of the medical information, I compact it or dissect it, and then I sort of send it out to family members. Or when the parents ask me something, I can look it up. I can talk to my colleagues and say, you know, have you, what do you think of this? Or, right. And kind of be a part of it that way.
Yeah. But so you can crystallize it.
Right.
To kind of make it more manageable.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And I think we part, you know, and they're participating with the MLD Society or Foundation, and that just kind of helps talking to other people and right. sort of how they've gotten through it.
Right.
But it's tough.
Yeah. But it sounds like for them and for you guys, action gives you some sense of empowerment, right? So
it really does.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So if a family's out there and they're like, okay, I think my kid may have some of these, has some of these signs, what would you say for a person or a family who might have just gotten this diagnosis or is simply looking for a diagnosis of some sort? What would you say to them? How could you guide them to get the correct diagnosis maybe earlier?
What should they be looking for? Yeah, so for someone who, to get it earlier, you know, if your child, again, is like struggling in school or, and they don't have a solid diagnosis, you know, and, you know, we like to say common things are common. You know, dyslexia is certainly more common than MLD. But if your kid doesn't quite fit into that, or if you're working with a healthcare provider that's like, oh, you know, I'm not exactly sure, you know, this, it's a point that you have to push and say, you know what, I'd really like to be a little closer to sure than not quite sure, or, you know, how does my kid fit into this and how do they not fit into it? And I think, you know, when like ADHD is a great example, because kids who have ADHD, once they start that treatment for it, whether it's behavioral treatment or medication treatment, they do really well. And if you don't have ADHD and right. you're trying, it's not going to work for you.
Yeah, I see
but
that.
Then you, yeah, then you have yeah. to find something else. And you just don't throw up your hands and say, okay, well, we don't know what it is. We'll just keep, you know, you have to keep pursuing. And it's tiring. Yeah. It gets expensive. And, you know, but that's so the kind of direction, yeah.
Yeah. So is this something like you could, if you suspect something's not quite right with your kid, you could go to your family doctor and have them point you in the direction for the genetic testing? Or
you could, yep. And they okay. should be able to, and I would hope they could. And part of this, they had asked us to, they almost wanted like a family tree of who has it and who doesn't. And so I got tested here at Mayo. I said, hey, my niece has this rare genetic disorder. I want to know if I'm a carrier. And I found out that I am.
Oh, wow.
So that was, you know, so now my parents, one of them has to be a carrier, but out of the three of us, the siblings, so two of us are carriers and we're still waiting on a result from our last, you know, from my sister to see, could all three of us have been carriers?
Wow.
So that makes a big, you know, I don't have biological children and, you know, it makes you think, wow, what if I didn't know this, you know, and genetic testing is being offered earlier now. It's some parents will get it, some are hesitant, and I would encourage you to get newborn screening and genetic testing if it's offered to you.
Right, right. Knowledge, again, knowing is empowering, right? Because right, they absolutely. Can put things into place and be ready for it, if you can be ready for it. But you know what I'm saying? Like, I truly believe that having a diagnosis or having medical knowledge about a condition is really freeing in a lot of ways, because then at least you know what you're dealing with and you're not
right. Working. Right. Absolutely.
So okay. Well, my heart is breaking, but I am hopeful that we will be able to figure something out that brings relief and, mm-hmm. and,
you know, she's going to Duke, to be screened for a bone marrow transplant. And that is something that you can do when you have symptoms of MLD. Okay. And it it doesn't improve the situation, you know, she's in. It'll stop it or slow the progression. It doesn't cure it. There is no cure, but of the available treatments, the gene therapy that we don't do here yet, there's bone marrow transplant. And again, what we had talked about earlier is that, you know, you're using somebody else's. So you're going to have, you know, you're going to have to get higher chemotherapy, and then you're going to need to worry about the graft versus host. Is this going to take? And then there's enzyme therapy. And I don't know a whole lot about the enzyme therapy, where they're replacing the enzyme that's missing, because those studies have really just started.
So
again, but if you could catch it earlier.
But again, bringing awareness is step one, right? So the more people that are aware, the maybe the more that, you know, different treatments or different things can be put into place. And the more people that are talking, again, this cross-pollination of information
might
lead to some breakthrough, hopefully. So sooner than later, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So Jory, most importantly, how can people help right now? What can we do?
You know, I think supporting, you know, groups like the MLD Foundation and their pursuit to get things like this included with genetic testing, with standard newborn screening, you know, so that parents can make that choice to screen out some of these rare conditions. So then you do know about it earlier and at a point where it is treatable or even curable. You know, for us personally, and also for, you know, the information, we started a GoFundMe page, and the first one, you know, was kind of like an immediate raised funds for some immediate needs. The one that I'm doing is really just our journey. It has a lot of information and links on, you know, the diagnosis, on what the processes we're going through right now. And so I'm trying to every week put something out there that either talks about MLD or talks about, you know, what the next steps are for us. And so certainly if people want to follow along on that, I have a lot of good links on it. And that's what I can say. You can just go on it just for the links, because it'll help direct you to, you know, articles by, you know, John Hopkins had a great article that was, you know, when daydreaming is, you know, more than daydreaming, like how do you fish that out, and just symptoms. And again, just more getting into the diagnosis of MLD.
Wow. That's wonderful. And I'll put all those links in the show notes and on the website. So that's a lot of information, and my brain is still, you know, it's, I'm going to be lying in bed 3 o'clock in the morning thinking about this, and, you know, like just how it goes. But I really appreciate you sharing this info. Can we pivot for a second and do
absolutely
some rapid fire questions? So these are kind of fun, and I'm gonna add one on the spot if you don't mind.
Okay,
at the end. So, so these are questions I ask everybody, and I just like to see what everybody has to say about it. But, do you have a mantra or some sort of vision statement you follow? And if you do, can you share it?
I do right now. It's sort of putting things into perspective. So it's hard on a podcast because you can't see my hands, but it's sort of like the season I'm in right now, or the situation, and then life. So, you know, right now I'm really busy with my niece, or like I, you know, gone to the hospital, gone to other visits, and it impacts everything, but it's such a small part of my life over my lifespan,
right?
That it's much easier to look at it that way. You know, this is just, you know, this would make such a huge impact for really not a lot of my time when I think about it overall.
Right.
So that's, you know, that's one of the things. And then, one of them is taken from, it's sort of along the same vein, And it's from a book on, I think, on savings or funds, but it's, you know, your 10-day, 2-week, 1-month, 5-year plan. And so it's kind of like, okay, what is this week going to look like? And that's manageable. And, you know, but what do I want to do? 5-year goal. So it's just setting these stepwise processes. Right. That sort of.
And it's interesting because kind of like writing a paper where your thesis statement is supported by paragraph, supported by your details. It's the same thing. Like if you're making weekly decisions that go against your 5-year goal, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Right. So it's great that you can analyze that. That's a big part of moving forward. That's awesome. I remember having talks about that kind of stuff with you on a beach many years ago.
Yeah,
but that's a topic for a martini and another show.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, that's girlfriend hour.
Right.
So the other question I have is, what is your best, most audacious failure? Favorite personal failure that you want to share?
I moved back to Hawaii in 2005. And that was the worst mistake.
However,
I'm where I am because of it. You know, when you kind of start out your career out there and it's laid back and, you know, people are surfing and kind of doing their thing, like you don't really notice it until you leave and come back.
When nobody shows up for work,
when nobody comes. Yeah, exactly.
Remember those days?
I'm like, huh. Well, I would really like to get this done today. But yeah. So Hawaii didn't change at all, but I really did. And it was just a mistake to think I could go back with, you know, having kind of grown up some and had different expectations and things I wanted, and none of that happened. And so then I had to come back home, but I didn't get to come back home to exactly where I left from. You know, doesn't, I'm just like, excuse me, Mayo, I'd like to come back. You know?
Shocking. Move on.
Just what I eventually did. But, you know, then I, and it was a failure in a way that I guess just really how wrong I was about my expectations and how I was going to just fit back in and how I was going to feel about it. Like I just did not have that expectation that things would be so different and I would feel that way about it.
Right.
And just really be unhappy.
But you know what? I see that, you know, all failure is a data point for growth. Right. And when you describe that your situation, how your expectation, you know, you were disappointed with all of this, it's really showing some growth, right? So you had grown beyond the person you had been the first time you lived in Hawaii, and you are a completely different person the second time.
Yeah, so, absolutely. You know,
and we're the sum of all of our experiences. So, you know, I always tell clients and families and colleagues that if you haven't failed at anything, you're either lying or you're not trying, right? Or both, because you cannot grow without failure. You just can't. So I always like asking people that because I want to take down the stigma of failure, because, you know, even when you're working out, what do? You drive your muscles till you can't go anymore. That's failure, right? So it's the same thing with your heart, your soul, your mind. And I think it should be celebrated and kind of taken down from this peg of where everybody's got all their stuff together all the time, when none of us have it together most of the time. So, you know, I certainly don't, but, and I think once we all realize that, then it becomes just life, right?
Yeah, exactly. It was a very humbling experience. And
those are the best ones.
I lived in my parents' basement for 9 months, you know. I'm like, yep.
Here we go.
But it was a launching point. Now you know it was a launching point because, so, all right. So what do you do on days where you do not feel motivated or you feel overwhelmed? How do you overcome that stickiness in your mind?
Well, I rely on my pets quite a bit. So because I think, I did this the other day where I had a lot, I really had a lot to do and sometimes feel guilty about, you know, am I going to get this done or that done? I don't have that, you know, it's not outside pressure. It's my within pressure to do certain things. But I took the dog out. We have two dogs. One catches, one does not. but I went out with Bandit and I played ball. And, you know, you're with this. He's so happy to be outside with you and do you just can't help but get out of that feeling, you know, when you're doing nothing but throwing a ball to this dog and he's bringing it back to you and he's got this, you know, goofy grin on his face and he's wagging his tail, you know, and the other dog, Josie, she's our old gal, you know, just sort of watching, but it's just such a nice moment and it's something that I can do so easily. And sort of take my mind off of things, or if I want to kind of think about it, but I want to be in a different environment. You know, the outdoors is such a great environment to, well, it is the environment to, you know, get, if you want a different perspective, and that just sort of, if I take myself out of the house or out of, or move my location, that seems to be really helpful for me.
These are good. Yeah, those are. And, you know, if you ever want it, I can give you the research that backs up why both of those interventions works for the brain. It's fascinating.
Oh, I love that.
Animals and nature, being out in nature, even imagining it, because our brains can't really tell the difference between reality and what we imagine. So, you know, that part of your brain will light up regardless if you're doing it or thinking about doing it. So there's a lot of power in that. And those are very, very healthy ways to reset your brain. So that's very cool. So I have one last question for you that I just want your on the spot reaction if you have one. And if you don't worry. So what would you say your favorite movie is?
My favorite movie is Shawshank Redemption.
Care to tell us why?
You know, it changes why I like it so much. Because I start to, you know, there's different characters and it's kind of an odd movie, I think, to like so much. Because parts of it are dark and sad and but parts of it are, you know, I just love it at the end too. He's on a beach, but I mean, but he did what he wanted to do. Like he suffered for a long time for something he really didn't do, but now he's like, you know, I didn't, you know, commit this crime. He's like, but I've done plenty of things, you know, I've haven't been good to people, or I haven't. So, you know, there's just a lot of different characters that we go through the storyline that I really
and it is in a way uplifting at the end.
It is, and it just it's you know, when you think about different, because it kind of shows you that, I mean, it's at a different time, and but that community and how you know, there's another character who's just so ingrained in the system that he can't function outside being in an institution. And you know, there's, it's just other, that really got me thinking about, you know, just different types of community or lives, or how we think of each other, how we treat each other.
That's powerful, Jory. Wow, that's a lot. Thank you.
I don't think that probably was the intent of that movie, but
now that we're reflecting on it, next will be movie critiques.
That's right.
Mary and Rory.
That's right. Oh gosh.
So that movie does get a 5-star rating from.
Yeah.
How can people find you? Do you want to be found?
You know, I have, if people have questions that they want to ask, you know, I'm not an expert on MLD. I'm not, I do love going to, you know, visits with people if, or, you know, one of the things I've done before is write up, you know, they're like, we're going to go see for this condition. What should we ask? Or what do I need to know? And so one of the things is from the provider's point perspective is to say, you know, here's some questions that your provider might not tell you that may be available or that you should know about, or you might want, you know. So I've actually done that quite a bit with just friends and some family.
That is invaluable.
But, yeah. It's you can reach me by email, which is my item.joy@gmail.com.
And I'll have that in the show notes as well.
Yeah. And I have, you know, the email I communicate with about Amelia is webelieveinunicorns2022@gmail.com. And the reason we pick that, you know, the GoFundMe has got everybody's name, and, you know, we wanted something a little different, and she loves unicorns. And so, we just kind of did it that way. It's, you know, that's a little goofy, but
like
we're all a little goofy.
Unicorns, really?
Right. You know, and it's just like, something a little different.
Right. I love
but
it.
I wouldn't mind that at all. That's fine.
Okay. Well, it'll be up there. So I will.
Okay.
That's there for you. So Jory, thank you so much for spending this hour or whatever it was with me. And I know this information is going to help a lot of people out there.
Well, so. I really appreciate the opportunity just to be able to talk about it. And, you know, there's certainly a lot of, you know, rare diseases, rare, illnesses, that, you know, you can't learn about all of them, but
right.
it would be nice to, like you said, build these communities around some of them,
right.
You know, and develop these people, even if we take the, you know, that disease part out of it, just like you said, having a community where people can talk about, you know, to your neighbor to say, like, you know, if you're having a conversation, my kid's really not fitting in with this, you know. People have ideas, people have, you know, something you might not have thought of, or you might have something that parent didn't think about, you know. So I think you're really it's fantastic and really spot on by the idea of building the community, because I really think that's
and networks
exactly,
you know, and that. Because we can't be experts in everything. Right?
Exactly.
So, but if we have connection to each other, then we can bring the expertise to everyone, you know, as much as we can.
Yeah.
So it's very important. And I think even above the information, I think it's important for people to feel that they're not alone, because right. So many of my families that have different diagnoses, varying degrees of disabilities, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for just knowing that there's somebody else out there who's going through something, and it's not just you.
Right.
A lot of times we feel very much alone when we're going through these things. So that community piece is part of the healing.
Right. That's so true. Absolutely.
So thank you so much. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate this. And thank you for putting it on my radar. I'm going to read up on it and learn about it. And, you know, anytime I'm in touch with people that I think might benefit from this information, I'll bring it to the forefront.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. So let's keep in touch on this and
sounds
maybe
good.
Circle back in a little bit and see how things are going, and if there are any updates on the research therapies and all that good stuff. All right.
Yeah, that sounds great. Thank you.
For more information, you can find us on Twitter or Facebook at BrainCogCoach, or visit our website at braincogcoach.com. I'll see you next time, and make it a great day.